So good afternoon. Welcome to everyone who's here today and those listening to us on the stations of Maine Public Radio. This is the 472nd meeting, Foreign Relations, and it comes to you from the Elks Event Center in Rockland, Maine. And I'm George Look. The Midcoast Forum was founded in 1983. And for the last 40 plus years, we have been hearing from an invited speaker each month on an issue related to U.S. foreign policy. You can listen to audios of past forum talks and get information about upcoming forum speakers on our website, midcoastforum.org. Recent forum talks are also on the websites of Maine Public Radio and the Maine Monitor. If you're interested in staying informed about key foreign affairs issues, please consider becoming a member of the forum, either if you're listening to us on the radio or you're here as a guest today. And our membership forum is on our website. Our speaker today is Professor Stephen Coonan, who will be speaking on the realities of climate and energy. Dr. Stephen Coonan joined New York University's Stern School of Business as a professor of information, operations, and management sciences in September of 2012. He is also director of NYU's new Center for Urban Science and Progress. Professor Coonan was confirmed by the Senate in May 2009 as Undersecretary for Science at the U.S. Department of Energy, serving in that position until November of 2011. Prior to joining the Obama administration, he was BP's chief scientist, where he was a strong advocate for research into renewable energies and alternate fuel sources. He came to BP in 2004 after almost three decades as professor of theoretical physics at the California Institute of Technology, serving as the Institute's vice president and provost for the last 9 years. He most recently held a position at the Science and Technology Policy Institute of the Institute for Defense Analyses in Washington, D.C. Professor Coonan is the recipient of numerous awards and honors, including the George Green Prize for Creative Scholarship at Caltech, a National Science Foundation Graduate Fellowship, an Alfred P. Lone Foundation Fellowship, a Senior U.S. Scientist Award, that's called the Humboldt Prize, and the Department of Energy's Ernest Orlando Lawrence Award. He is a fellow of several professional societies, including the American Physical Society, the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences, and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. Professor Coonan received his Bachelor's of Science degree in physics from the California Institute of Technology in 1972 and his PhD in theoretical physics from MIT in 1975. Steve, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Thank you, George. Well, what a treat it is to be speaking in this informal setting to what I already know is a serious and engaged audience. My topic today is about climate and energy, and it's certainly front and center in the news in many ways. We do know that the average temperature of the Earth has gone up by about 1.1 or 1.2 degrees Celsius since the start of the Industrial Revolution. But you can see from this graph that it's not so simple, perhaps, because while carbon dioxide has been growing in the atmosphere, the rise of the temperature is not steady. It goes up, and then it goes down a bit, and then it goes up again. That carbon dioxide, which is accumulating in the atmosphere largely due to the use of fossil fuels, exerts a warming influence on the planet. And so the key questions that this circumstance presents to us is, how and why has the climate changed in the past? How will it change in the future under natural and growing human influences? How will those changes affect society and ecosystems? And perhaps the money question, what do we do about all of this? Society's response to these circumstances really has to strike a balance. On one side, we've got what climate science tells us, or doesn't tell us, the risks and benefits of a changing climate. On the other side, we've got the world's growing demand for reliable, affordable, and clean energy, and the technical and economic realities that condition satisfying that demand. And in striking that balance, we've got to worry about our values and priorities. What's our tolerance for risk? What are equities between countries, between different generations? And how effective and costly is anything that we try to do in response to a changing climate? All of these three elements are pretty complicated compared to what you will hear from the media or the politicians. And if we're going to make wise decisions, we've got to have a full appreciation for the nuances and complexities of the science, the energy technologies, and what we might do about it. So I want to tell you a little bit about each of these three elements, perhaps things that you might not have heard before. And I'll start in on the climate science. Unusually for fields of science, there is an official statement of what we know and don't know about climate science. These are defined by assessment reports that are put out periodically by the UN. They're called AR5, AR6, was issued 2 or 3 years ago. And the US government similarly puts out reports. When you read these reports, as opposed to the summaries of the reports, they say important and surprising things. And what's in fact true is that most people have not read these reports. I know because they run to thousands of pages, and you need to be a scientist to really understand them. It took me several years, at least, to understand these things. So most people get their information about the climate from the media. Perhaps they have read the summaries, which misrepresent in ways that I will show you. Nevertheless, let's have a look at some of what's in the reports, and maybe more importantly, some of the actual data. I'm going to start with an observation that climate is not weather. Climate is defined as the properties of weather averaged over several decades. The official definition is 30 years, although people talk about shorter and longer periods. You can see that distinction by looking at this data set, which is the height of the Nile River, measured at its minimum every year in Cairo. And it's about 800 years of year-by-year data. Needless to say, the Egyptians were very concerned about what the height of the Nile River was. The people who ruled Egypt were even more concerned about it, because it determined agricultural productivity. And what you can see is that year by year, there are enormous fluctuations. One year it's up 6 meters, and then the next year or two, or the previous year, it's down to 1 meter. But if you average over, let's say, 30 years, you get this red curve, which shows a much smoother behavior. But surprisingly, it goes up and down as well. No human influences here. This is well before greenhouse gases from people became important. And you can just imagine some medieval Egyptian climate panel screaming, "New normal, new normal," as Egypt descended into drought in that first 150 years, urging more prayers and sacrifice. And of course, all they had to do was wait 100 or 200 years. Okay. So lessons are climate varies a lot on its own. And the second is, do not get too excited about what happens in, let's say, 10 or 20 years. Here's a surprise. If you look in the most recent IPCC report of a couple years ago, you find this table, which shows whether various types of climate impact phenomena have emerged or not. And you see heat and cold listed, wet and dry, wind, snow and ice, maybe for people on the radio, about 20 different phenomena. And what is surprising is that most of the entries in this table are blank. There are a couple that are filled in. Yes, we're seeing higher temperatures and more extreme heat. We're seeing fewer cold spells. We're seeing the mean ocean temperature going up. But the rest is blank. One of them that might, in fact, catch your eye is having to do with hurricanes and storms. And let me show you that data right now. Here's a record of how many tropical storms, the strong ones are called hurricanes, have occurred over the last 55 years globally. And then on the bottom panel is a record of how active those storms were. And what you can see is that there are no obvious long-term trends at all in these data over 50 years. Yes, the activity graph goes up and down, but it goes up and down a lot. And in fact, the official reports say that. There's low confidence in any reported long-term increases in activity, low confidence in most long-term trends in the frequency or intensity measurements. It may well be that there is a trend there, but it just has not emerged yet, according to the official reports. Bit of a surprise when you hear the news almost every day saying extreme weather is getting worse. Right. Heat waves, much on people's minds. Here is the EPA official website for the incidence of heat waves in the U.S., the continental U.S., since about 1895 up until 2021. And again, what we've seen in the last couple years is not at all different than what we saw at the beginning of the 20th century, at least according to the EPA. When I learned this kind of stuff, I was really surprised, and I felt actually a little bit swindled by what I had heard in the media. Since we're in New England, let me just remind you that New England has seen heat waves. The New England Historical Society says in July 1911, well before human influences were significant, thousands of New Englanders were killed and sent to the brink of madness. On July 4th of that year, there was 103 in Portland, 104 in Boston, which is still a record for the Boston temperature, 105, 106 in the region. And then in May of 1896, there was a heat wave in July and August, which was the worst weather-related tragedy in American history up until that time. 1,500 people died. So heat waves are nothing new. The real question is, are they becoming more and more frequent? We hear a lot about people dying during heat waves. Here's some data from an article in The Lancet a couple years ago. It shows the fraction of deaths in various countries attributable to extreme temperatures. And what you can see, first of all, over all of these countries, is that the fraction is about 6-7%. But what's surprising is that most of the deaths are due to extreme and moderate cold, and very few are due to extreme and moderate heat. In fact, the ratio of cold-related deaths is about 10 times that to heat-related deaths. And so as the planet has been warming, yes, there are more heat-related deaths, but there are fewer cold-related deaths, and those outweigh the deaths in heat. So on average, because of the warming, fewer people are dying from extreme temperatures. As an example of the misrepresentation, if you look at the summary for policymakers in the latest IPCC report, you'll find a sentence something like, extreme heat is contributing to mortality, but not a word about cold-related deaths declining. Not a word. I would have failed one of my students had they done something like that. Well, what about the last year or so? It's gotten really hot, or at least it feels that way. You can get some insight into that from the satellite-measured temperature of the lower atmosphere. This is a record from NASA, 1979, up until last month, actually, July. There are monthly variations from year to year that go up and down a lot. The average is the red curve, which has a smooth rise with some ups and downs, of course. And then every once in a while, you see spikes. Those spikes are associated with El Niño events, which are climate or weather events that happen in the Pacific every 5 years, 7 years or so. But the climate is this smooth trend going up. What's unusual is you see a spike at the end of the record in the last year or so. Part of it is due to the fact that we are coming off of an El Niño now, and the expectation is it will return. But part of it may also due to the fact that we have cleaned up the pollution in the lower atmosphere, allowing the Earth to absorb a little bit more sunlight. We've had an undersea volcano a year or two ago that put a tremendous amount of water vapor into the stratosphere that can exert a warming influence. We don't know exactly. The betting is, of course, that this will come down and is a return again to that smooth trend associated with increasing greenhouse gases, among other things. Well, that's a little bit perhaps surprising information about the climate of today and the past. What about the climate of the future? The climate of the future, we try to project based upon enormous computer models. The problem is one of the grand challenges in computational science, because we're trying to find the effects of a physically small, human influences on the climate are a 1% effect, 2 watts per square meter out of 240. So we're going to change the climate by 1 or 2%, change the input by 1 or 2%, and we're going to run this complicated model for 100, 200, 300 years and look to see whether there are differences in the weather, for example, the average temperature. In order to do that, you cut the globe into squares, about 100 kilometers on a side, and then you build up 30 layers in the atmosphere, 30 layers in the ocean. Altogether, you've got maybe 100 million voxels, boxes, and then you follow the flow of air and radiation and water through these boxes. You do that 10 minutes at a time, and you do it for 1,000 years. You look at what the model does, and you say, that's the climate. Grand computational challenge. Needless to say, there are many different models. The world has about 40 or 50 of them, and they all give different answers that don't agree with each other, and certainly in the details, and many of them do not agree with the observations itself. Why is that? Why not? It's just physics. Well, it's not just physics. For example, these boxes are 100 kilometers on a side, 60 miles. There's a lot of stuff in the atmosphere that happens on much smaller scales. Thunderheads, for example, are the most obvious. Hurricanes are a couple times that size. And so you can't describe all that in detail in each of these boxes. You got to say what happens inside based on the average properties in the box. The temperature is such and such, the humidity is such and such. Where are the clouds? How many of them are there? People do the best that they can based on observations, based on physics, but in the end, you're making assumptions about what happens inside the boxes. Different people make different assumptions, and so you get different answers. This statement that the projections are not fit for purpose is not mine, but appears in an article published by Tim Palmer and Bjorn Stevens, two of the leaders of the field. Here's just one example of them. In the upper right panel is shown the sensitivity of about 40 different models. There's one from the US in Princeton, there's one from the Max Planck Institute in Germany, and so on. And what's plotted for each model is the sensitivity. How much would the temperature go up if you doubled carbon dioxide in the atmosphere? And you can see about 40% of these models, the ones showing the yellow bars, are deemed to be too sensitive to the climate, and they get thrown out by the IPCC. That's pretty disheartening. 40% of the models produced by the best modelers, trying as hard as they might, are just a priori wrong. Okay. Gives some sense of how difficult it is. By the way, the least sensitive model is produced by Russia. When you look at how well the models reproduce the temperature history, the black lines in the lower left are the observations of the surface temperature of the globe. The different spaghetti lines are the individual models. And you can see that many of the models differ from the actual observations by more than the change we're trying to describe. As they said, the models are not fit for purpose. Nevertheless, people project. Let me focus in on sea level projections. I live in New York City. Part of the time I grew up there. And there's been a tide gauge measuring the height of the ocean at the Battery since about 1860. And we've got a continuous record. So if you can take the official government record and look at how fast has the sea level been rising at the Battery, let's say since 1920, you get a curve that averages about 3 millimeters a year. That's a foot a century, but goes up and down. And yes, it's running at 4 millimeters a year recently, but it was doing the same in about 1950, even as human influences were growing. Last year, or the year before, NOAA, the part of the government concerned with climate, put out a report saying that 1 foot of sea level rise by 2050, over 30 years, was locked in. Didn't matter what emissions were, didn't matter what model you used, we were going to see sea level rise by 1 foot. Well, that would give us the red bar. It would take the average up to 10 millimeters a year in 2050. Who am I to challenge what NOAA says? Right. On the other hand, when you display it like this, it leaves some questions in one's mind. I always like to put something local in. Here is the NOAA data for the tide gauge in Portland. And you can see data exists since 1910, and it's been going up at a pretty stately progression at about 2 millimeters a year, about 8 inches a century. We can ask, what about the rate? Has it accelerated? Is it going up faster in recent years? The lower panel shows the NOAA graph data, official government again, for the rate. And you can see it averages about 2 millimeters a year, as expected, a little bit less than New York, because New York is actually sinking, the land is sinking, not so much here. And if the NOAA report were to be put on this graph, it would jump up to about 8 on this graph by 2050. Again, as one of my colleagues would say, I'll bet my house that doesn't happen. Right. Okay. Nevertheless, that's what NOAA puts out, and that's what you get in the papers. Well, what about impacts of all of this on society, the economy? One powerful observation for me is that if we look since 1900 to the present, the globe has warmed by 1.3 degrees Celsius. During that time, we have seen the greatest flourishing ever of human well-being. Population has gone up by a factor of 5. Life expectancy went from 32 years to 73 years. The literacy fraction went from 20% to 80%. GDP per capita went up by a factor of 7, and the death rate from extreme weather events went down by a factor of 150 or 200, something like that. Okay. All this happened despite the warming. Now, the UN projects that we'll see about the same amount of warming over the next 100 years. And for me, it beggars belief to believe that that's going to derail things. Nevertheless, you can say, well, something bad might happen. We've already broken the climate, people say. Well, have we? I don't know. This shows economic losses from extreme weather events over the last 32 years. Two things to take away from this. One is that the average is about 0.2% of GDP. We have trouble measuring GDP to that precision. And second, the actual trend is down a little bit. Well, okay, things still might get worse. What about other aspects? Agricultural yield. This shows agricultural yields, food production since 1960, and we've seen spectacular growth in our ability to grow enough food on a limited amount of land to feed the entire planet. Some of this, maybe about half improvement, is due to the fact that carbon dioxide has actually gone up. Plants love carbon dioxide. If you go into a greenhouse, we crank up the concentration in the greenhouse to 1,200, 1,300 parts per million, whereas the ambient atmosphere is 400. So, not everything about climate change is bad. One more about economic impacts, and then we'll move on to response. This curve shows the predicted decline in the US GDP as a function of how the global temperature goes up. Take away from this, first of all, the declines are a couple percent for a couple degrees of warming. There are different estimates, 12 independent estimates from the research literature. The black line is the average. Couple percent for a couple degrees of warming. What's remarkable about this, I mean, if you study the literature, you know this, but what's remarkable is that this chart was put out by the White House last March, okay, and the OMB and CEA, and I'm wondering whether the White House political arm is really reading what the analytic arm is putting out. Because you still hear existential threat, climate crisis, and so on. I think the bottom line for me in all of this is, yeah, there's probably something happening here, but by no means is it a crisis, nor is it an existential threat. Nevertheless, we should probably do something about it, and let's talk about what the responses might be. Emissions of greenhouse gases are continuing to rise. Emissions of CO2 last year are at record levels, consumption of coal, oil, and gas. If we're going to try to reduce human influences and stabilize the concentration at something that the UN thinks is safe, we've got to go to effectively zero emissions over the next 30 years. So that rising curve has got to be turned around, according to the curves on the right, by 2050, 2070. The world, almost 200 nations signed up in the Paris Accord, pledging to reduce their emissions, consistent with trying to reach this goal. And we have embarked, not only in the US, but in Europe, other countries, on a so-called energy transition in order to eliminate the use of fossil fuels. You might ask, how is it going? Well, I like to use that cartoon to describe how it's going. There was great enthusiasm in Paris for doing something and tackling the problem. And in the last year or two, the world has realized that there are some fundamentals that spell a very bad outcome for the effort, just like Wile E. Coyote here realizing. Let's talk about some of those fundamentals. What we find is that as people become better off, they use more energy. Or the converse is also true. In order to become better off, people need more energy. This chart shows how energy consumption changes with the GDP per capita of many different countries. And there are a lot of countries who use a lot of energy and have a pretty high GDP per capita, the US among them. But 50% of the globe's population, 4 billion people, are in the lower left-hand part of this graph, with a per capita income of less than $10,000 a year. And their energy use increases steadily and universally as they become richer, or vice versa. Again, they need energy for mobility, for light, heat, and so on. And so as those folks improve their lot, as we should hope that they will, energy demand is going to increase. We're going to see a 50% increase in global energy demand by the middle of this century. Most of the growth, as you can see, is in Asia, where there are an awful lot of people who are not very well off. Some in Africa as well. Can we do that without fossil fuels? Well, I think it's important to understand a couple things about energy systems. Energy is not delivered by technologies, it's delivered by systems. There's the electrical grid, there's the system that produces fuel, extracts oil out of the ground, refines it, delivers it, and the system that produces vehicles to use it. Energy systems are naturally slow to change. They take decades because the assets involved live for a long time. The system has to be highly reliable. And the system has to work as a system. You can't change the fuel without changing the vehicles, for example. So this chart shows where the U.S. got its energy from 1950 to 2020, 70 years. And you see things don't change very rapidly. Most of the energy comes from fossil fuels these days, a little bit from nuclear, and a little bit, but a growing amount, from renewables. So you need to change energy systems not by tooth extraction, but by orthodontics, slow, steady change. This shows just how recalcitrant the global energy system is. This shows where the world gets its energy from 1965 up until today. And you can see fossil fuels, oil, coal, and gas, still provide 82% of the world's energy. We're spending a couple trillion a year on renewables and are not making much of a dent in this, certainly not consistent with the goal of getting to zero by the middle of the century. There are other realities. We talk a lot about the troubled triangle of the grid, or the trilemma, the electrical grid. We would like our electricity to be affordable. We'd like it to be reliable. And we would like it to be clean, not only in the sense of carbon dioxide, but also in the sense of local pollution. And, you know, it's like the old quip about communism. Smart, honest, and communist. Choose 2 out of 3. Right? So affordable, reliable, clean, choose 2 out of 3. Affordable and reliable, coal and gas work really well. Affordable and clean, wind and solar, but not very reliable. You want to be clean and reliable, but expensive, you've got nuclear and carbon capture. Let me show you why you can't run the whole system on wind and solar. This is a graph of how much electricity was produced, or actually fraction of the capacity, for the UK by wind for 6 months from 2020 to 2021. And you can see a lot of variability day by day over these 6 months, and you say, okay, I can build storage, I can use batteries and so on to smooth out that variation. But what's disturbing is that 10-day minimum, 11 days, shown in the right part of the chart. For 11 days, the wind hardly produced at all. And you had better have, if you're going to have a lot of wind, you had better have some backup system in order to fill in that gap. By the way, these gaps occur often enough in every venue, whether it's Texas, California, UK, Germany, that the Germans have a name for them. They're called Dunkelflauten, which means dark stillness. Neither the wind produces nor the solar produces. And so they need, as the UK needs, a backup system. And because the Dunkelflauten can last sometimes a month or more due to the vagaries of the weather, the backup system needs to be as capable as the wind and solar. And so you wind up running two parallel energy systems. And so the cost is going to be at least twice as much. That was why I like to say wind and solar can never be more than an ornament on the real energy system, which must be reliable and affordable generation. Okay, so where are things going to go in the future? It might be reinvigorated. We've seen a lapse in it. There's been political changes in Europe. There have been pushback here about vehicle mandates, heating mandates, and so on. I think if we make a good connection between extreme weather and climate human influences, you might see that. More likely, I think over a century, we'll see a decline in emissions, but people are going to lose enthusiasm for this, as they have lost in other issues that do not have an immediate payoff. What we will do as a society is focus on adaptation and resilience, and the history of the last century or two shows that we are wonderfully adapted species. All right, last slide. What do we do? What I would do if I were advising the politicians, they won't listen to me, of course. I'd cancel the climate crisis. We have over-egged the custard, to use the British phrase. Too much hype. At the same time, acknowledge that there is a task and challenge here to reduce human influences on the climate. We have to have better observations and understanding. The ocean is the most important part of the climate. We have terrible knowledge of the deeper parts of the ocean and what they're doing. We must not constrain the developing world's energy supply. When the World Bank or the IMF tells Vietnam it cannot build a coal-fired generating plant, that's just immoral. Right? Those countries should have the same opportunity to get energy that we have. I think we need a greater focus on adaptation and resilience. Technology is going to be the way, ultimately, we reduce emissions. I would develop and demonstrate small modular reactors, grid-scale storage, batteries, and so on. And then formulate a graceful way of reducing emissions. Right now in this country, we're just throwing stuff at the wall, spending a lot of money, inducing a lot of turmoil in society, and hoping that we'll find something that'll have some impact. With that, thanks for your attention. I'm happy to take comments and questions.
Thank you. Certainly, you've given us a lot to think about, which is kind of our goal in getting various speakers in here. You said a lot about renewables, solar and wind, but you didn't mention much about either fission of nuclear reactors or the prospects for fusion energy. Can't those be a major contributor here that would replace fossil fuels?
Full disclosure first, you know, I spent much of my early career as a nuclear physicist. So I can tell you a lot about fission. I'm not sure I could design a reactor, but I can tell you a lot. Look, fission right now provides about 19% of U.S. electricity, provides 78% of French electricity. It's a proven technology. We know how to do it. We can do it better. I'm a big fan of small reactors, maybe one-tenth the size of the big ones, for economic reasons, but we've got to have the will to to do it as a country. Other countries are pursuing it already. China's got 50 reactors underway in construction. I think the world, you know, even Michael Schellenberger, Stuart Brand, people who were rabidly green, have come around to the realization that we need a good dose of fission to make it happen. Fusion is a different story. There have been advances. We're able to create and confine plasma right now with much greater finesse than we could before. I was proud to have played a small role in making ignition happen on the big laser at Livermore a couple years ago. I chaired a committee in 1995 that said, go ahead and build that thing. We're not sure it's going to ignite, but there's a good chance. So it took 30 years. I was pleased. But it's going to be a long time. On fusion, you got to make the plasma and control it. We're getting pretty good at that. The second is you need to build a vessel that will withstand the intense radiation and particle flux from the plasma. And we're not really able to do that yet. And the third is you got to make the fuel, the tritium for fusion. And nobody's demonstrated that they can make enough fuel to keep the thing self-sustaining. So decades off, but progress, and worth pursuing as a more than research project, I would say.
Your last slide kind of gave your views on your hypothesis, the best things we can be doing. But what data would you see that would prove that your hypothesis is, that your hypothesis is wrong here, that we need to do more than you're talking about?
That there's not a crisis, right? And I think, you know, if we see on a 10 or 20 year trend unusual things, hurricanes getting really strong, drought, well, even droughts, you know, the drought in the Southwest, right? Since 1990 or so, this California, the Southwest has been in drought. And the governor, of course, used the new normal phrase a couple years ago. And then to his chagrin, perhaps, we've had a number of wet years in California. So you can get fooled a lot by this. Better observations of the climate.
Someone wants to know why our government or our media is manufacturing climate crisis in light of the data that you've been presenting to us today. What could be motivating this?
How could that possibly be, right? For the media, so I have two quips maybe. For the media, if it bleeds, it leads. And, you know, you would never see that data that said essentially nothing's happening with hurricane count or hurricane activity in the papers, right? It's always crisis. Something bad's got to happen for the media. For the politicians, I love this quote from H.L. Mencken in the early 20th century. The purpose of practical politics is to keep the electorate alarmed by a series of mostly imaginary hobgoblins so that they can be clamoring to be led to safety. Okay. Climate, Y2K, immigration, fentanyl, missile gap. Right. You see it done on both sides of the political aisle. And I think the job of the scientist, to the extent that some of those things involve science, is to try to bring the factual basis to the table. But it's pretty hard to get through to the media. The New York Times, Wash Post have, you know, dozens of reporters on the climate beat. And their job is to produce stories that will sell the paper. Most of them are not trained in science. They don't take time to understand. They'll take a press release and add a couple sentences and put it out. So you got to look deeper at the papers, at the reports, at the data. I taught, I'm leaving NYU now, as you know, and headed for Hoover at Stanford. But I taught for 5 years climate science and energy at the master's level, two separate courses. And in both of them, I taught just from the official documents. And the eyes got wide open in both courses. And the students come out with a better appreciation for the nuances involved in the subjects.
So if not into reading thousands of pages of these documents, what do you consider to be publications that we should read to get a broader picture, to get a more accurate total picture?
Boy, that's hard. That's really hard. You can read my book. Just on the book, I'm happy if people will read it, and we've sold 200,000 copies of it. Many people come back and say, thanks for writing. You'll find everything in the book is referenced to the reports and the official documents and so on. I mean, there are contrarian or non-consensus voices out there. Judy Curry, Dick Lindzen. They are worth reading to get an alternative view of these things based in science. These people are scientists as well, quite credentialed in many
cases. And you mentioned there was a couple of $1 trillion a year invested in renewables. Isn't it worth it? I mean, shouldn't we, in long term, be thinking about decreasing our impact on nature?
Reducing our influences, sure. That's one side of the balance. It's not obvious, as we were discussing, that renewables are the best way to do it. You know, the Inflation Reduction Act, a terrible misnomer. It's got nothing to do with inflation except to cause it. Puts in $60 billion, $70 billion of tax credits for wind and solar. So if you essentially can put up a wind farm for free and reap the rewards. If wind is the cheapest way of generating electricity right now, which it is, why are we subsidizing it? People should take to it naturally. Plus, too much wind destabilizes the grid, as I tried to indicate. So I'm no fan of wind and solar for that reason.
So you focused on the effects on human beings, but we've got other little friends in this world, the wildlife, plants and animals. Shouldn't we be considering them more in all of this?
Absolutely. But, you know, the ecosystems are really hard to instrument and to measure. I'll just give you two stories. Polar bears, right, were iconic symbols of the polar bear stranded on the ice floe. You don't hear about that much anymore because the polar bear population is resurgent. And coral reefs, right? The Great Barrier Reef was going to disappear. The last 2 or 3 years, we can check the exact numbers, we've seen record increases in the coral as the conditions change. So you got to be careful about this echo stuff. Check the data, multiple sources, etc.
And then you haven't also mentioned some things like tidal power. Is that something we should be using? There's one up in Canada.
I've no doubt that there are some places in the world where tidal power might work well, but remember how hard it is to build something that survives in a marine or water environment. One example I know close to home is maybe 15 years ago, people wanted to put turbines in the East River next to Manhattan. As you may know, that's an estuary, so its flow reverses with the tides, and they gave up after 2 years. You got to remember, any of these schemes not only has to work, but it's got to be better than the alternatives, because in the end, it's a commercial venture. So I'm no fan of tides. Ocean thermo is another one that people talk about. Geothermal, nah. Okay. Come on. Great research projects. We can get research grants. We can do a startup and cash out, but no.
So if human influence is on climate change is only 1% to 2%, which is, I believe, what you said, why should we even try to reduce our impact at all?
That's an excellent question. I would love to ask that to the politicians. I think prudence at some level is a reasonable strategy, but not prudence that's going to disrupt society, break the bank, and constrain half of humanity to more expensive and less reliable energy.
And someone here says, your past historical charts seem to ignore the recent speed and density of the human-induced carbon in the atmosphere. Aren't they increasing? Is there going to be a break point at which all of a sudden you say, oh my God, we did get there, and now the crisis is real?
Look, climate by definition is a 30-year average, right? So it's not going to set in for, it'll take a couple decades to set in at least, and we will have time to respond. I was going to try to find the, see if I can find the, oh, we're back at the beginning. I'm not a Mac person, so. If you look at the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is, yes, it's accelerating gently in the last few decades, but there's no sudden spurt in the carbon dioxide.
We have a couple of questions. Predictions that climate change is going to trigger mass migrations from Africa and elsewhere. And we're starting to see an increase in those migrations. Are those caused by climate change?
Human behavior is so complicated. Climate is probably a factor, but a very small factor. Right? How do we explain the fact that the general migration in the U.S., despite the wonderful situation you have here in Maine, the general flow of people is to warmer states? Right? And that's not because of climate, perhaps, but it's because of economic, cultural reasons, and so on. Right? So, you take the island of Hispaniola as another example. I'm sure people would love to migrate out of Haiti, but the Dominican Republic is doing just fine, all right? And so that's more about how society organizes itself than it is about climate.
So how about there's been a lot of reporting in the news about effects of climate on the Atlantic conveyor system, the Gulf Stream and all. Will there be massive effects should that system be reversed or disrupted?
Should it, yes. But, so just for people to understand, there's something called the AMOC, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, which carries water up in the Gulf Stream, it sinks around Greenland, and then comes down in the bottom of the Atlantic Basin, a major flow of heat from the equator to the poles. There are hypotheses, some might say fairy tales, that gradual equilibration of the temperature at the pole and the equator will slow that down. And every few years, there's some paper that comes out and says, we see a slowdown, but it's only 10 years. And often those papers are superseded by the papers that say, we don't see any slowdown. I would quote Carl Wunsch, who's a distinguished, maybe the most living distinguished oceanographer today. He's at Harvard, used to be at MIT. Kerry knows Carl well, I'm sure. Carl said, that can happen. The Gulf Stream is there because of Coriolis forces and the equator to pole temperature difference.
The question here about whether we're using the right metrics here, isn't the dollar cost of hurricane damage a more salient indicator than the number of hurricanes?
So NOAA loves to quote billion-dollar damages, right? But they forget the fact that there's more and more infrastructure built up on the coast over decades. And so when a hurricane hits, even though there's no change in its properties, it will cause more damage. It's kind of hard to quantify infrastructure built up on the coast, and so people use GDP as a proxy.
This is an interesting question. More people means the need for more energy, and the need for more water, and the need for more food. Isn't population more of the problem than climate?
If you look at the growth in projected growth in energy demand between now and 2050, it goes up, as I said, by about 50%. The population doesn't go up by 50%. It goes up by 20-something percent, right? From 8 billion to, let's say, 9 or 9.5. That means that most of that growth in demand is due to development and is not due to population. Yes, if there were 1/4 of us living on the globe than there are, we would use 1/4 of the energy. But the growth in the next couple decades is due to development, not due to population.
You said that you thought, you know, politicians, and you quoted one, potentially profit from climate change. Are there others who profit from, not profit from, advertising climate change as a crisis? Are there others who benefit from keeping up the drumbeat?
Sure. There is the climate industrial complex, to echo Eisenhower's military industrial complex. If you started up a wind company, a solar company, a battery company, and suddenly the mandates or subsidies are taken away, you're in big trouble. So yes, there's the American Wind Association, et cetera. There's the American Nuclear Association. So everybody's got a stake in this. The oil companies, of course, don't want to see fossil fuels disappear either. One of the things you didn't mention about my bio, I think, I was for 5 years the chief scientist for BP. And they brought me in not to help them find oil, but to help them figure out what Beyond Petroleum really meant. And so when I talk about the private sector and energy, I've got a little bit of an inside view in how they think about these things.
So is your bottom line is that we shouldn't be...
No, we should do something. We should do it thoughtfully. It's not a crisis. And we should attend to many other priorities that the nation and the world has. If you want to help the half of the population that needs more energy, global population, it seems a pretty indirect way to reduce fossil fuel use in the developed world to help the developing world. Much better to get them energy, refrigeration, light, mobility, information, than to say, well, 30 years from now, things might be a little bit better than they would be otherwise.
And just one final question. Would you buy a real estate in the coast of Florida?
No, but that's not for climate reasons.
I thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.